From 90.9 WBUR, I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is Radio Boston. Coming up, details on the allegations made against On Point host Tom Ashbrook. We'll also have the latest on the explosion in New York City this morning.
Anyone can go on the internet and download garbage and vileness, and that is the reality that we live with.
Also today, why scientists are worried the North Atlantic right whale is even closer to extinction.
Right whales have been living in this environment for millennia. If they're now not able to survive in that environment, then we better be paying attention.
And a father who lost his son to a mass shooting wonders when it will end.
You know, if I have anger, if I have confusion, if I have anything, it's just for that reason. This killing, these murders, this constant stream of suffering is something that we could do things to stop.
That's next on Radio Boston.
Thanks for listening to the Radio Boston podcast. If you'd like to support WBUR, go to radioboston.org and click the pledge button in the upper right-hand corner. Okay, back to the show.
This is Radio Boston. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. 11 women and men have filed a complaint against On Point host Tom Ashbrook. The multi-page document includes accusations of name-calling, belittling critiques, and unwanted touching. Ashbrook says he was, quote, stunned that a few former colleagues have apparently come forward with allegations that have not been shared with me, end quote. On Point is a nationally syndicated NPR show produced by WBUR. WBUR and Boston University have placed Ashbrook on leave while an outside investigator reviews the allegations. WBUR's Martha Biebinger is reporting this story for the station. And full disclosure, I worked as a producer and director at On Point for almost 5 years. I am not one of the 11 complainants. But to avoid even an appearance of a conflict of interest, I will not be hosting Radio Boston's coverage of this story. Instead, today you'll hear the debrief between WBUR's Martha Biebinger and Morning Edition host Deborah Becker. They spoke this morning about the latest on what we know.
11 accusers. Who are they and what do they say?
They are men and women. They are current and former employees. Last Thursday, they say they delivered a 15 or so page document with testimonials that allege Ashbrook routinely belittled their ideas in meetings, called people names, screamed about what they considered minor punctuation or font errors on scripts, and created an overall toxic, emotionally unsafe environment. Deb, I heard this from one former producer who signed the document and another who reviewed it. In total, I communicated with about a dozen people who had experienced the work environment at On Point. One of the accusers, a former producer who's a woman, says the alleged abuse included an additional element for women. With them, she says, Ashbrook would often end a tirade with an unwanted hug or back rub or neck rub. Staff I spoke to say this went on for years and had lingering effects on their mental health or their career path, with some leaving journalism.
And Martha, what does Tom Ashbrook say?
He responded last night in a text saying he's proud of the people he's worked with during 16 years at WBUR. I'm going to read a quote now, Deb. I am stunned that a few former colleagues have apparently come forward with allegations that have not been shared with me. I have no idea what is being alleged or by whom. In the pressure of a live radio environment, I have at times been a tough and demanding boss. We aspire to put on a top-notch show. Many people have thrived in that environment. A few have not. And that ends the quote, Deb.
So Tom Ashbrook says he has no idea of what's being alleged. What were you told, Martha, about how complaints were handled?
Among the dozen or so people I spoke to, there were three other former employees who are not part of the 11-member accuser group. Some former producers say Ashbrook is a great host, a terrific journalist. But they also describe sitting in meetings while Tom would berate colleagues, most often young women, interns, or freelancers. These former producers are still angry that they couldn't find a way over the years to stop the alleged abuse.
And none of these people complained before now, Martha?
The people I interviewed say every now and then someone would tell Ashbrook to stop or yell back. But Deb, it didn't seem to make a difference. At least five people I spoke to say they raised concerns with station managers more than once. They say they were told, among other things, Deb, to write Ashbrook a letter or that it's just his style to manage with intimidation. In a few cases, according to the allegations, Managers told employees they were willing to have a high turnover at the show because Tom is a star. In a few cases, producers claim they were told by managers that their jobs could be at risk if they took the complaints any further. These producers say it's unconscionable that WBUR let young producers keep cycling into this environment, which they call abusive.
And Martha, what does WBUR say about these allegations and the suggestion that it ignored complaints?
Last week, our general manager, Charlie Kravitz, said he is committed to a positive work environment for everyone at WBUR. Last night, when asked for further comment, he said in an email that, quote, "While I would like to respond to your questions, it would be inappropriate for me to comment while an investigation is underway." That ends the quote.
And in terms of that investigation, any update on the timing of that?
No, it was just a Friday that the station and university announced that these complaints would be reviewed by an outside investigator. None of the people I spoke to this weekend had been contacted. The show continues today without Ashbrook as a host. Deb, Ashbrook ended his text to me last night saying, quote, "I can't describe how deeply upsetting this is to me. I am sure that once the facts come out that people will see me for who I am, flawed but caring and decent in all my dealings with others." That ends the quote.
WBUR reporter Martha Biebinger speaking to WBUR's Morning Edition host Deborah Becker about allegations against On Point host Tom Ashbrook. Martha will continue her reporting in the coming days and weeks. And just to repeat my full disclosure, I did work as a producer and director at On Point for almost 5 years. I am not one of the 11 complainants, but to avoid even an appearance of a conflict of interest, I will not be hosting Radio Boston's coverage of this story as it evolves. Let's turn now to New York City, where police are investigating an attack this morning in an underground walkway near Times Square. Law enforcement officials say the suspect is in custody. They identify him as 27-year-old Ikeyed Ula. Allegedly, he tried to set off a pipe bomb strapped to his body. Here's New York Governor Andrew Cuomo. He called it a, quote, unsuccessful attack and pointed to New York as a common target for would-be terrorists.
This is New York. The reality is that we are a target by many who would like to make a statement against democracy, against freedom. We have the Statue of Liberty in our harbor, and that makes us an international target. We understand that.
Well, joining us now with the latest is Rebecca Ibarra. She's a reporter for WNYC in New York. Rebecca, thank you for joining us.
You're welcome.
So first of all, what more do we know about anyone who was injured beyond the suspected attacker?
So beyond Ula, there were three people reported with minor injuries. So these people actually took themselves to the hospital after the explosion, and they went to the hospital with injuries like headaches or ringing ears, but nothing more serious than that.
Okay. And as for the suspected attacker himself, he sustained some serious injuries, but has he, I presume he's getting medical treatment now, has he spoken to law enforcement officials?
Law enforcement officials said they were questioning him at the hospital. They would not, as the latest press conference that they gave, they would not say what he was saying, but they were questioning him at the hospital.
Okay. And tell us more about what we know about him.
So we, as you said, he is 27-year-old Ikeyed Ula. He is from Bangladesh. He was here on a family visa. It is reported that he had a license to drive for hire cars that expired back in March 2015, though the commission in charge of that in New York City couldn't actually pinpoint whether he did drive for hire cars at that time. Police are, they're not confirming to me whether he is from Brooklyn, but we do have a reporter in the Kensington neighborhood of Brooklyn right now. And there is a residential building there that is under heavy police and FBI investigation. No one can go in and out unless they can prove that they live in the building. And other than that, they're not saying anything else as to where he lives exactly.
Mm. Has he said anything or have law enforcement officials said anything about motivation?
No. It was reported that he may have been motivated by ISIS via, you know, the internet or videos. They are saying there is no evidence that he was in direct contact with them. So other than probably a motivation via the internet, we don't know anything other than that right now. And we don't even know, they weren't telling us exactly what he said as the explosion happened, whether he, you know, yelled something out or what he said. So we don't know that yet.
Right. So, Rebecca, you know, when we heard the story, the news this morning in Boston, of course, one of the first things I thought about is that not only is this this area of New York vitally important to New York City, right, because mm-hmm. of the Port Authority bus terminal and train station, Times Square, et cetera, but, you know, thousands of Bostonians every day go from here directly to visit you guys through that station.
Yes.
Can you tell us a little bit about sort of what the situation is now? Is it open? And how are New Yorkers feeling about what happened today?
So it is open. As I was leaving the area around 11 a.m., the Port Authority was slowly opening up. Obviously, there were dozens, if not hundreds of people out in their cold with their luggages just waiting to hear, you know, what was next. So they did lock it down. It is open. The subway is slowly up and running as well. Officials were saying they were hoping that by the time evening rush hour comes, subways will be up and running, as well as the Port Authority. Obviously, buses are delayed, so it's going to be a very tough day for people who were traveling in and out of New York City.
Well, that's Rebecca Ibarra, reporter for WNYC in New York. Rebecca, thank you so very much.
You're welcome.
Well, let's turn now for another perspective from Max Abrams, I should say. He's a political science professor at Northeastern University. He studies terrorism. Max Abrams, welcome back to Radio Boston.
Thanks for having me.
So what's your reaction to what I guess officials are calling sort of a failed or an unsuccessful terrorist attack in New York?
Well, you know, there's wide variation in the quality of terrorists, if you will. If quality is understood in terms of their ability to commit harm. Some terrorists, especially those who have been overseas, who have experience in conflict zones, be it Libya or Syria, the fear is that they'll come back with enhanced skills. This guy seems to have been, you know, quite unsophisticated. He had a crude, improvised explosive device on him. It's not entirely clear whether it detonated at the right time. And the only one to sustain any serious injuries seems to have been the perpetrator. And so that indicates that to the extent that there is some kind of Islamic State connection, and we don't know that yet, but if there were one, it would seem that, you know, he's probably not directed. He would be more like a lone wolf-inspired type. He does not seem to be part of a network as far as we know now. And so, yeah, if he got radicalized, it was probably online, and he probably didn't really know what he was doing.
Mm. Well, to that point, I want to play a little tape to you from White House Press Secretary Sarah Huckabee Sanders, who spoke just a little while ago. She first thanked first responders, saying that their response was heroic. But then in talking about what happened in New York this morning, she pivoted to President Trump's immigration policy.
This attack underscores the need for Congress to work with the president on immigration reforms that enhance our national security and public safety. We must protect our borders. We must ensure that individuals entering our country are not coming to do harm to our people. And we must move to a merit-based system of immigration.
There's actually quite a bit to unpack there, Max, but I'm wondering what your response is to her.
Well, to the best of my knowledge, Bangladesh is not on the list.
It's not.
Of banned countries, so he would be let in. I think that the problem, to the extent that they see one, and I'm not sure I agree, is that he was part of, I guess, what they're calling chain migration, where he was let in with some kind of preferential visa status because perhaps he has family mm-hmm. That's citizens here. I mean, but this is a very, very wide net. And so, you know, counterterrorism really needs to be quite focused. It does not want to needlessly discriminate much more broadly because that risks, you know, radicalizing the broader population and eroding the quality of intel. And also there are just some serious, you know, normative reservations one could have about that coming from the land of the free, et cetera. I mean, this guy, to the best of our knowledge, was under the radar. He was not known as a radical. He didn't, you know, as far as I've seen, have any sort of criminal, major criminal record in the United States. In such a case, there's very, very little that law enforcement could have done, especially because it looks like he was targeting
yeah.
a soft target. And, you know, it looks like also he was prepared to die because the weapon was attached to him. So given his lack of record, his essentially following the laws of the land, his working alone, his high levels of resolve to attack anyone and even to possibly martyr himself, there isn't really a whole lot that we could have done.
Well, Max Abrams is a political science professor at Northeastern University. He focuses on terrorism and counterterrorism as well. Professor Abrams, it's always a pleasure. Thank you so very much.
Thank you.
We'll be back. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is Radio Boston. Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. Well, it hits every winter, but this year it's hitting a little earlier than usual. Flu season. And with us to share the latest on this year's virus and the vaccine against it is Carrie Goldberg, host of WBR's Common Health. Hello, Carrie.
Hello, Meghna. And believe me, it gives me no joy to tell you this, but flu season is officially here. Here's Dr. Larry Madoff from the Massachusetts Department of Public Health.
In the state and in the country, we seem to be having an earlier than usual flu season this year. I'd say we're about 3 or 4 weeks ahead of where we would be in a typical year, but many years are atypical.
Oh, dear.
So, yeah, it's here. So typically the flu season peaks in late January or February, can be as late as March. And there are some predictions that in this very early flu year, it could be really high, even right around the winter holiday season already.
Oh, great. So family, friends, loved ones gathering together for the holidays, time to spread the flu.
Yeah, it's not the best gift you could give them. And we don't know for sure, but it looks like this could be quite a bad flu year. So though the very latest numbers from the state show a slight drop over the last week, so that's good. But still, we're definitely in the flu season now. And we can look at what happened last summer in the southern hemisphere, because, of course, our summer is their winter. So they've just had a flu season. And we can see their indications of what will happen with our flu season. And Australia just had a very bad flu year. So lots of cases and lots of severe cases.
Yikes. Okay, so what are we seeing nationwide then?
So, well, Lynette Brammer, she's the CDC's chief flu tracker. I just spoke with her earlier today, and she says it does look like an early season nationally as well, and a nasty virus.
So far, H3N2 viruses are predominant, and those do tend to be years where we have more illnesses and hospitalizations because they affect the elderly and the very young.
Okay.
More.
Oh, sorry, I talked over her. I'm so sorry about that. But okay. Carrie, here's what but anybody who hasn't got the flu vaccine yet, though, it's not too late.
So it's not too late. And health authorities are still absolutely clear that getting a flu vaccine is the best way to prevent the flu. But there's some not so great news about the vaccine in the New England Journal of Medicine.
Okay, so, I keep groaning. But I got my flu shot.
Good
I
for
did.
You. That was the right thing to do.
But it still hit me with the bad news.
Okay, so a leading federal expert, Dr. Anthony Fauci and his team write in the New England Journal that there's a mounting concern about this year's record levels of flu in Australia. And that's because the dominant strain of flu there is this nasty H3N2 that we just heard about. And Dr. Fauci writes that it's looking like the vaccine in Australia was only about 10% effective against this H3N2. And our flu vaccine has the same composition as theirs did.
10%?
Yeah.
Okay, wow.
Yeah.
So is it even worth getting
it? Yeah, so in a word, yes. So the latest American data find that the vaccine is about 33%. So it's better, 33% effective against H3N2. Here's Lynette Brammer from the CDC again.
Even while 33% is not as great as we would hope, even then you prevent thousands and thousands of illnesses and thousands of hospitalizations and deaths. So even though it's not as good as we want, it still can have a very beneficial effect.
And the vaccine overall, last flu season, overall, it cut your risk of flu by 39%. And it can make it less severe if you do get it. So it's still worthwhile, they say.
I mean, some prevention is always better than none, right?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yes.
Now, here's the thing, though, Carrie. Usually what you hear about the flu virus is that, influenza mutates really quickly,
does.
Right? And
mm-hmm.
it takes months to make millions of vaccines.
Yeah, 160 million vaccines a year in America.
So it takes a long time to manufacture those.
Mm-hmm.
And so sometimes I guess the strains in the vaccine just aren't a good match for the current strains of the virus out there in the wild, right?
Because it's mutating so fast.
But even then, though, the 10% effectiveness of H3N against H3N2 in Australia, that just seems so unusually low.
Yes, so it is low. But Fauci in the New England Journal of Medicine suggests a possible factor. The virus mutation quickly is a factor. But this other factor he mentions is that the flu vaccines are grown in eggs. So I spoke with Dr. Cody Meissner. He's the head of pediatric infectious disease at Tufts Medical Center. And he says the problem with eggs is that the vaccine makers start with a human flu virus. And so growing it up in eggs is not what the virus would really prefer to do.
It has to go through additional mutations in order to adapt to growth in the egg. So making the changes that are necessary to grow in the egg make it a slightly different virus than the one that's circulating in the community.
So the vaccine against it, we already have a problem getting a good match, and then growing the vaccine in eggs might make the match even worse, including with this nasty H3N2 strain.
So many questions. Let me just ask you the obvious one, Carrie. Yes. Can we get vaccines that are not manufactured in eggs then?
Right. So the answer is they do exist. There are a few that are grown in cells rather than eggs. But I asked Dr. Matta from the Department of Public Health whether these concerns about eggs mean we should shop around for those non-egg vaccines. And he says no.
Not at this point. I think that there isn't evidence, that currently that the cell-based vaccines are more effective. I think that the best flu vaccine is the one that you get. And so I wouldn't shop around too much. I would just get a flu vaccine. That's the most important thing.
And he says, you know, the state of the science is advancing, but that's over the course of years. It's not something for this year. And of course, the great hope is that we'll eventually get a universal flu vaccine that would work against all strains of the virus. And then we could stop having to get one every year.
I can't wait. Because Carrie, you do a public service because you nudge us every year to actually get a flu vaccine.
Yes. My nagging gives me no pleasure. I want you to know that. And really, for now, you know, we just have to say, look, flu is serious. The official numbers that Dr. Fauci cites are that it can, in a bad year, kill more than 50,000 Americans, and it can land more than 700,000 in the hospital. So we have to do what we can to fight it.
Okay, so get the flu vaccine, even if it's not 100 or 75 or 60% effective.
Yeah,
and always wash your hands. There's basic public health measures
we
can take.
Yes, wash your hands, cough into your elbow, stay home if you feel sick, especially if you have a fever.
Well, Carrie Goldberg is editor of WBUR's Common Health, and she's our official flu vaccine nag. You can find a link to her recent post about this year's flu season at radioboston.org. Carrie, thank you so much as always.
You're welcome.
. 2017 has been a devastating year for the North Atlantic right whale. 17 right whales have died off the coast of Canada and New England this year. Only 5 calves have been born. That from a report from the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration. Now, the North Atlantic right whale has been one of the on the endangered species list since 1970. But now the total population hovers around just 450 whales. So they're that much closer to extinction. Joining me now with more is Dr. Roz Rolland, a senior scientist at the Anderson Cabot Center for Ocean Life at the New England Aquarium. Dr. Rolland, welcome to Radio Boston.
Great. Thanks for having me on.
Well, what is causing the death? 17 seems unusually large for such a small population. How do they die?
17 deaths is devastating for this population of highly endangered whales. We were unable to examine every single carcass, but every carcass that was examined was killed by human activities, in particular, either being hit by a ship or entangled severely in fishing gear.
I see. So boat strikes or fishing nets. Okay.
That's right.
And can we talk about the flip side of things for a moment? Is the birth of only 5 calves unusually low?
Yes, it's incredibly alarming for an endangered species. So we figure there are approximately 100 females of reproductive age in this population, and with a birth rate of that should be a calf every 3 to 4 years, we should be seeing about 30 calves born every year. So only five is just a very alarming. And obviously with 17 deaths and five births, it's not a sustainable situation.
So it's the worst of all worlds then for the North Atlantic right whale then, on both getting squeezed on both ends. What was different in 2017 that we know of?
Well, it seems as though actually starting in 2010, the pattern of the habitat uses by right whales has shifted. So places where we used to see a lot of right whales, like the Bay of Fundy, many fewer right whales were going to those habitats. And many more right whales have been going up to the Gulf of St. Lawrence. And this year in particular, a lot of right whales were sighted up in the Gulf of St. Lawrence, more than had been seen previously. The thing about that is that we had measures in place, for instance, in the Bay of Fundy, to reroute ships to try and protect right whales, whereas none of these measures have been put in place as yet up in the Gulf of St. Lawrence, although the Canadian government is actively looking at instituting some regulations.
Mm. Well, so let me just ask you in a little bit more detail. I mean, are the whales following the food? Is that why they're going further north?
That's right. That's what we think. So right whales eat this little zooplankton about the size of a grain of rice called Calanus finmarchicus. This organism likes cooler water temperatures, and we know that the Gulf of Maine has been warming faster than almost everywhere else on the planet. So what we believe is happening is that the right whale's food source is headed north, and right whales are following the food, and therefore it's taking them into areas where they're not as well protected.
So just to reiterate something you said earlier, and I hope I'm not oversimplifying things, but climate change is part of the picture here.
Well, that's what we believe, yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
But in terms of going back to the ship strikes and the boat strikes, though, I'm a little confused because, I mean, right whales are already on the endangered species list. And aren't there regulations in place already in the United States about the distances that boats have to keep from the whales?
That's correct. Yes, by law, nobody can approach a North Atlantic right whale closer than 500 yards. However, right whales wander all over the place. They don't stay in areas that we have designated as habitats. And there's a heavy amount of ship traffic up and down the eastern seaboard when you think about all the ports coming and going. And the Gulf of St. Lawrence is like a superhighway for ships. So it's impossible to control the situation completely. Some of the measures put into place in Canada and the U.S. previously have been very effective, slowing down ships when right whales are present at the times of year where right whales are present, some rerouting of shipping lanes away from areas where we know there are high concentrations of right whales. And so there are, you know, solutions in hand, and we need to expand those protections to the areas where we're finding right whales now.
I hate to be too much of a downer about this, but the reality, as you've been saying, is that there are 450 of these whales left in the world, right? And I'm seeing that maybe only 100 breeding females. Even with all the protections in place, is it a kind of a dark future for the species?
Well, we are at a critical point where changes need to be made immediately to if we want to save this whale. This year was particularly bad, and we just can't afford to have too many years like this, or we will no longer have this species on the planet.
So then what more would you like to do to protect them?
So expanding the protections in terms of shipping that I was just describing, slowing ships, rerouting ships, in habitats like the Gulf of St. Lawrence, where right whales are now appearing. But the most common cause in recent years of deaths of right whales has been severe entanglements in fishing gear.
Uh-huh.
So we need to find a way that fishermen can fish and right whales don't get entangled. And both the fishing industry and many scientists, including my colleagues, are working actively on that.
Yeah. You know, in the last minute that we have, I remembered the long history, right, that the North Atlantic right whale has with humankind. Correct me if I'm wrong, but it's named the right whale because in the age of whaling, it was a prime species to go after because of the oil that the whales make naturally.
That's exactly right, Magna. It's the oil was derived from the blubber, right?
Yeah,
whales have very
right.
thick blubber layers, and it also was the baleen, which are the plates, comb-like plates that right whales use to strain food out of the water. Those were used before plastic came around. They were used as flexible material like plastic. So basically, humans have been the problem for right whales for thousands of years, really. And they're very resilient animals. If we give them a chance to bounce back, I think they will.
Well, now they have fishing nets, ship strikes, and climate change to add to the list of the pressures on the right whale. But Dr. Roz Rollins, senior scientist at the Anderson Cabot Center for Ocean Life at the New England Aquarium, thank you so much for joining us and telling us about this latest challenge that this critical species faces in our waters. Thank you.
My pleasure. Thank you, Meghna.
We'll be back. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is Radio Boston. Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. On December 14th, 1992, Gregory Gibson's son Galen was shot and killed at his school, Bard College at Simon's Rock in Great Barrington, Massachusetts. The shooter was an 18-year-old fellow student who randomly fired at people with an SKS semi-automatic rifle loaded with ammunition he'd ordered over the phone. At the time, the shooter said he was receiving commands from God. In the 25 years since, Greg Gibson has tried to understand both why and how his son's life was so easily cut short that day. He's even exchanged letters with his son's killer, who's currently serving two life sentences. Then, earlier this month, in an extraordinary StoryCorps conversation, we heard this.
My name is Greg Gibson, and I'm speaking with the man who killed my son.
My name is Wayne Lowe. I'm sitting here with the father of Galen, whom I murdered 25 years ago.
As StoryCorps says, Gibson was not looking to forgive or to find closure. But nevertheless, it was the first time Gregory Gibson and Wayne Lowe met face to face. And Gregory Gibson joins us now. Welcome to Radio Boston.
Hi, Meghna. Nice to be here.
Can I just first ask you the obvious question? I mean, why is it that you decided to have a face-to-face conversation with the person who killed your son?
Wayne Lowe, the man who murdered my son, and I have been corresponding for 20 years, and we've agreed throughout the course of that correspondence to use our stories to try to ensure that no one else has to go through what we obviously have gone through. About 3 years ago, I had the idea to take that conversation and make a commercial out of it, make a public service announcement. But I could get no traction until StoryCorps came along. And the question lingering over that whole conversation is, what is this guy doing? You know, why is he doing this? Survivors of the Simon's Rock shooting in which my son was killed were mortally offended and deeply injured that this killer, his voice, that he was given prominence, that he was given a voice, that he was given a public place. And then, you know, just the general public, so many people came up to me and said, I cried all the way into work, you know, and I felt terrible. All these people crying. What if there were traffic accidents as a result of tears? I mean, I felt like saying, but I never did. Thank you so much. I appreciate your feeling, but I don't want your tears. I want you to jump up and call 10 Republican senators and tell them not to pass this stupid concealed carry reciprocity bill or things of that nature, you know.
So can I ask you just a little bit more? So the StoryCorps conversation is the only one that you had with Lowe. But how long? We heard about 5 minutes of it. How long did you actually talk with him?
I think it was about a little over an hour.
There's a lot that we didn't hear.
You bet. Yeah. Wayne walks in the door. I mean, we've never seen each other face to face since the criminal trial. He walks in the door, takes one look at me, and bursts into tears. Now, of all the reactions that in all the scenarios I played through my head before this event, that was the last thing. I mean, I just didn't expect it. And, you know, the rest of that hour, a great deal of that hour, was the theme.
Since you mentioned that how much we heard was dominated by Lowe's own tears, I just want to play a little couple of seconds from your StoryCorps conversation because there's a very specific question I have about a particular moment from it. And so this is from the middle of the conversation, and Wayne Lowe is talking about the fact that he never personally knew Galen, your son, but had seen him on campus.
I didn't know Galen personally at Simon's Rock, but at a trial, you spoke about how you guys came on campus that time, and
came out of the car and everybody gave Galen a standing ovation. I was there. I was there, Mr. Gibson. I was there. I didn't know him, but I stood up to him. He's, I knew. Everybody loved him.
Well, we sure did.
Greg Gibson, of all the possible things that you could have said to Wayne Lowe in that moment, you chose empathy above all. I mean, what else did you want to say to him?
Well, geez, I don't know. You know, it wasn't a choice. I mean, this is stuff our family has been working through for 25 years. And after that amount of time, I think this stuff is just, it's part of who you are. You know, this stuff just comes out. I mean, isn't that what empathy is? It just, it's just what comes out of you. Yeah.
Well, and then what came out of you right after that is you tell Wayne Lowe, this is sure exhausting, isn't it? I mean, that's the voice of a father.
Yeah, yeah. Well, it's kind of weird, isn't it? I mean, you never want to get tricked or trapped into the feeling that somehow I've swapped Galen for this kid. There's no way in the world that I feel like he's has any relationship to me. He's the guy who killed my son, and that's the relationship. But you still, you know, he's another human being. He's struggling. God, I can't imagine, you know, what somebody like that lives with.
Yeah, but
day after
but
day.
But I mean, but what about you, Greg? I mean, you're living with it too.
Yeah. Well, you know, listen, I've devoted my energy and my life to trying to salvage some useful thing from this horrendous, stupid waste. You know, that's been it from day one.
5 years ago, after the Sandy Hook shooting, I called you because you had written an op-ed in the New York Times, and I asked if you'd be willing to talk with us. I called you on a weekend, and you spoke with me over the phone, not on the air, but over the phone very graciously, and you kindly declined. The way I remember it, you were angry that this had happened again, disgusted, and just, I remember you ended up reading your New York Times op-ed to us on the air, which was the most that you wanted to do at that moment, because, I mean, you had told me that you just, that people only come to you after these mass shootings, and in the long run, you're not sure if anyone actually cares because we're not doing what we need to do to change this. I mean, do you still feel that way? Do you still feel that in the long run, America just doesn't care?
Boy, you know, Chester Himes, the great writer, after the people, the white guys who had tortured and murdered Emmett Till for whistling at a white woman, after they were acquitted of their crime, Chester Himes said, you know, the worst thing about this whole situation is when people realize that if they wanted to, they could stop it. Mm-hmm. And they're not stopping it. You know, if I have anger, if I have confusion, if I have anything, it's just for that reason. This killing, these murders, this constant stream of suffering is something that we could do things to stop. There's 300 million guns out there. Are we going to stop it completely? No, I don't think so. But we can change this culture. We can change this shoulder shrug where, oh, God, you know, it's awful, but we can't help it.
Yeah.
You know, just think about it. All these mass shootings, they're like, this is like reality TV for us. This is a consumer product now. It's terrible.
Yeah, you know, what you wrote in the New York Times 5 years ago, I'm summarizing it. I mean, you basically said that dead children are the price that America pays for our high tolerance for mass violence and for gun violence. And
sure.
Greg Gibson, if I could just say, if you said to me right now, you don't think that America really cares, I wouldn't blame you at all, because I'm thinking, even in the wake of the Las Vegas shooting, when a man opened fire using what was essentially a weapon converted to fire like an automatic weapon, shot more than 500 people, the United States Congress still could not pass any legislation around maybe making these sort of this equipment harder to get. And the only thing that the House was able to pass is actually going to make it easier for people to carry concealed weapons across state lines. I mean, what? Yeah, maybe America doesn't care about dead children.
I think you're channeling Greg Gibson, or maybe I'm channeling you. Yeah, what person in his right mind would find that a normal, sensible reaction to this kind of slaughter? So, yeah, we've got to change something. I mean, we've got to get cowards out of Congress. We've got to get people in there who understand that sensible gun laws can save lives. But, you know, it's not going to be all just legislation. Years ago, I went into Boston and talked to one of my old-time colleagues and comrades, Tina Sherry, whose son was killed just a year after Galen,
right,
again on the streets of Dorchester rather than a college campus. And she started the Lewis D. Brown Peace Institute. I could never quite figure out what they were up to because they didn't seem as politically active as I thought they ought to be. And I went in there and she said, you know, this moment of violence is what all the shouting is about, but that's not where we work because there's all this time before that moment and all this time after that moment. And that's where we work, all the time before and all the time after. How did it get to murder? How do we make this anything but a dysfunctional, vengeful, broken community? And I realized that advocacy isn't enough. Legislation isn't enough. When we had the AIDS crisis, and when we were thinking about, remember the cancer, what cancer was like in my parents' generation. It was something scary. It was something that was everywhere, and we didn't want to talk about it. And we fantasized about a cure for cancer that became like a, you know, like just a saying sort of. And look what we've done. We've treated AIDS, and we've treated cancer, and we've treated so many of these other things with a whole barrage of therapies. And I think ultimately, you know, if we're ever going to get out of this horrible nightmare of gun violence, that's how we're going to do it.
Some folks listening might say, you know, we do have some evidence, though, that states that have tighter gun control laws, mass gun violence is lower in those states than others. So isn't there room to push for more laws on where these weapons come from and who uses them?
Oh, I believe so, completely. Yeah. I mean, there's no coincidence between the fact that Massachusetts has some of the most stringent gun laws in the country, and it also has the lowest murder rate in the country. Gee, is that a coincidence or not? You know, I think there is stuff we can do to legislate. But let's go back again. You know, 300 million guns, Mega, out there with shelf lives of decades, if not hundreds of years. They're not going to go away. So we need more than just good laws. We desperately need good laws. That's why I'm still working for Every Town and Moms Demand Action. People like groups like that that are out there doing things, getting things done. But it's not going to be just laws alone that solve this problem.
Yeah.
We're sick. We're sick as a country.
So let me ask you about that, because you've had to think about this for 25 years now. And look, I take your point that laws aren't going to be the ultimate solution. But I feel like there's something that we as a nation, maybe it's the sickness that you're talking about, that we're just not grappling with enough, right? That we haven't faced enough. What is that thing?
You know, one of the survivors in the course of my activity said to me about a month ago, she says, people always come up to me and they say, I can't imagine what you're going through. And she says, and then I think to myself, well, maybe you should try to imagine what I'm going through, because if you really could imagine it, you might get up and do something about it. You know, in Newtown, I remember they sent teddy bears. They sent truckloads of teddy bears. Newtown had to rent storage space to store these teddy bears. And it's like, oh, God's sakes, why don't you vote for universal background checks or magazine size limits? And no, I think I'd rather send a teddy bear. You know, it's just that kind of thing that we just, I have no answer for the question that you ask. How do we miss that piece? What's wrong with us? Yeah.
Yeah. It's not fair of me to ask you that a question like that, because, you know, this is something that we as an entire nation need to be thinking about. Like, what are we missing?
Mm-hmm.
What are we not talking about?
What are we not talking about here?
But you've been put in this position of being, you know, a member of a terrible you know, I don't want to call it a club, but a group of people who have found themselves in a place that they never wanted to be.
Yeah, we call it a club. We call it the club nobody wants to join. Yeah.
Because, I mean, I remember in the StoryCorps conversation, again, with Lo, the person who killed your son, you talked about how, you know, that your family is proud every day that you are working for Galen, but that also that people don't want to have to keep doing this. The this being, you know, talking about the latest shooting.
But yeah, or the difficult emotional work of just, I mean, it's in a horrible way, it's easier for survivors. And who am I to talk? I mean, it's something we think about every day because we know what it is. But you, if you're just a regular, normal person, you don't want to think about that. You can't imagine it. And you don't want to put yourself there. It's the last place you want to go. But every person who's killed, there must be 10 or a dozen people around them that are profoundly affected. And every year there's 30,000 people killed and 100,000 injured. And how much longer do we have to go until the majority of people in America are survivors? Is that really what it's going to take for this thing to turn? Maybe it is. You know, they talk about, yeah, my grandson is like crazy about this zombie apocalypse. Well, maybe things aren't going to turn around until we have a survivor apocalypse. Is it going to really have to get that bad? I don't know.
You know, we're coming up on the anniversary of the actual day of your son's death. What do you do on that day? How do you remember him?
Well, actually what we do is the family goes down to the graveyard, which is right down the street here, and we have a little Christmas tree business that we run. We sell Christmas trees over the holiday. And so we take a little Charlie Brown Christmas tree down to the grave and set it up on the grave. You know, it's my wife and me and my daughters and sons-in-laws and relatives and grandchildren, and we set the tree up and put some decorations around it, and the kids run around. And it's actually something that we can do as a family, including Galen. So it's a rich and nuanced affair and not at all the sad, melancholy thing that you might expect it to be.
Yeah. Can I ask you just one more question?
Sure.
I'm looking at a picture of Galen right now. It's a black and white photograph of him, and he's just looking directly at the camera, but looking directly at me since I'm looking at this picture, and he's got these intense eyes that just, you know, there's a little mischief in there. There's kindness. There's a sense of, I feel like there's a lot that he knows in this picture. It just makes me want to tell me more about him. I mean, is there a story about him that really encapsulates the person he was?
You know, I think he was a wise and deep person. When he was young, he was so different than other kids. I think he suffered enormously socially, really. He couldn't figure out where he fit in. I remember times talking to him in fifth and sixth grade, and it all seemed so black. It all seemed nobody understood, and he didn't know. And, you know, I mean, he went through all this stuff, and somehow, on the other side of puberty, he had learned, because he had just this lovely mind. This, you know, it was so good in so many directions. He was so quick. He could so improvise. So, I think he really learned from his own experiences in life. And yeah, by the time he was 18, you know, in his last years, he was this enormously empathetic human being, really smart about people, really understanding of people, really patient with people. In a way, you know, he's sort of my inspiration for all of this, because at the time he died, he was really pretty advanced in those terms. You know, you think, geez, what would he have, where would we be today? Well, I don't know, but I think it would have been a pretty good place.
Yeah. Well, Gregory Gibson's son, Galen, was killed 25 years ago at a shooting at Simon's Rock College. Gregory's also author of Gone Boy, A Father's Search for the Truth in His Son's Murder. Greg Gibson, it's been a real privilege to speak with you. Thank you so very much.
Well, thanks for letting me talk about this, Meghna. It's so something that needs to get talked about a lot, and I really appreciate you giving it a little time here.
We've got a long ways to go.
Got a long way to go.
And we've got links to Greg's writing in the New York Times and that StoryCorps conversation he had with the Simon's Rock shooter. You can find all of that at radioboston.org. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is Radio Boston.